Revelation 13 is where we are today. Last night I had kind of like a weird dream. I don't normally start sermons, but like I had a little bit of a weird dream last night. In my vision, I saw a great gray beast with like tusks and a trunk like an elephant. And this beast was like standing like a man, stars girded his waist, and his front feet were like hands ready for battle. And then I looked, and it was crazy. It was like I saw another beast rising. Like it was another great beast with like hooves and ears like that of a donkey. And it too stood like a man, like a warrior ready for battle. And around its waist, it wore white and crimson stripes. In my dream, there were these two terrible beasts that were approaching each other, their faces touching, their eyes fixed on each other, their ferocity terrible. They both wore like wounds and bruises from endless battles. But this calls for wisdom. They are preparing to struggle once again. When I woke from my dream this morning, I sketched out a vision of this dream. Like on a sheet of paper, I drew it really quickly. You can go ahead and throw a slide one up there. I drew it for you guys so that you guys could like visualize it, because it feels really important. It feels like it might be something that's like going to impact all of our lives very, very soon. All right, you caught me. I have a little bit of artistry in me, but I didn't draw that. And I didn't have a dream last night. You're right. I didn't draw this picture or have that dream, but that doesn't change the fact that this cartoon will be impacting all of our lives very soon. This week, in fact. Most of us know what this is. It's a cartoon. It's a particular kind of cartoon. It's a political cartoon, right? Most of us, sometimes we see these things like online or in a magazine or a newspaper. Kids, you're like, oh, these are boring cartoons that like adults seem to laugh at, but I just don't really get, you know, something. That was the way I viewed it as a kid. If you don't know very much about the United States or its culture or its political world, then this cartoon would be rather difficult to understand. You'd be a little like I was when I was a kid. Okay, what does that mean? Because most of us do know something about American culture, about political world, you know, we understand something of this strange vision, don't we? Most adults in America are familiar with the Republican and the Democrat parties. They're the two big political parties that it seems like everybody in culture wants to shoehorn or push you into one of these two things. Most of us know that these two political parties, these two groups of people is really what these things are often represented by a donkey and an elephant. Most of us know that like stars and stripes are symbolic, patriotic emblems of the United States. And most of us know that in case you have been living under a rock, there's an election going on this week. This is a cartoon, but it's, I don't think anyone would deny, it's rather serious business, isn't it? It's a cartoon, but it's serious business. This is a way of capturing, like in an image, realities that really have nothing to do with like literal pachyderms or actual donkeys. This is a way of capturing bigger realities that are going on. I think that's the kind of thing that God gives us in Revelation 13. We said last week that John, the author of Revelation, who's receiving a vision from Jesus himself, Jesus has given this to him, he's shifted his storytelling a little bit in chapter 12. For the first 11 chapters or so of Revelation, it was telling a rather straightforward story, but then
Well,
fairly straightforward. Yeah, with breaking seals and four horsemen of death, and you know what I mean. But like, and trumpet blasts and all that. But it was a fairly linear story being told in the first 11 chapters. But then in chapter 12, John seems to shift into something, his storytelling into something like animation. Like mythic kind of animation. John begins animating something like a big cartoon for his churches. In chapter 12, he introduced us to like a dazzling woman and a terrifying dragon with seven heads and 10 horns and a child. A child whose very life seems to have defeated all the powers of darkness. John's begun to paint with like big, like primary colors. Just gonna use red and yellow and blue. Those are the primary colors, right? Yes, I was off script, but I was making sure I got it. He's painting with like primary colors. He's describing like big, exaggerated kinds of characters, and he's doing this to try to give us some sort of perspective. We're all so close to the world that we can't really see what's happening in the world, so he has to draw it this way. Last week, we heard John saying something like, there's this child, there's this guy, he's a literal, actual child, God, Jesus, who's very coming into the world has defeated all of the powers of darkness. It's like a war has been won on a cosmic level. If you want to know what kind of world we live in, I will tell you, churches, seven churches, our world is a fairy tale. Our world is a great, magical fairy tale, a place where evil and darkness and dragons do exist, and a place where all of them have been defeated. And then towards the end of that last week, we saw like something like a Roadrunner cartoon, right? It was that like the forces of evil kept chasing God's people. The dragon kept chasing the woman. He kept trying different tricks and kept opening Acme boxes to try to capture the woman. But it's like the woman just keeps getting away. It's like everything in the universe is conspiring against the dragon. The people of God are, John seems to be saying, are safe. People of God are safe in some sort of like ultimate sense. But then as chapter 12 ended, this is the last verse of chapter 12. It's not going to be on the screens. It ended with a frustrated, furious dragon storming off to make war. Verse 17, then the dragon, enraged at the woman, then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to wage war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus. It's like John saying, the people of God, in some sort of ultimate sense, are safe. The woman herself is safe in an ultimate sense. She's being preserved in the wilderness, remember, for like 42 months, for 1,260 days, for like some period of time, a time, and half a time. She's going to be safe in the wilderness. She's safe. But the forces of evil who have been defeated are now going off and waging war against individual communities, against individual Christians. They may still be living through some rough stuff. Even though the war is won, there's some battles still being waged against those who hold fast to the testimony of Jesus. Evil's been defeated, but it's still lashing out with its dying breaths. And that's where we left things last week. That's the end of chapter 12. John shifted into animation, and he's describing the events and the reality of Jesus' birth almost like a political cartoon. We need to keep that in mind this week, because chapter 13 is a doozy of a chapter. What happens, just to let you know, heads up, spoiler alert, in chapter 13, in like some sort of clumsy imitation of the woman, because that's all evil can ever do. Evil can only ever imitate the good. In some sort of clumsy imitation of the woman from last chapter, the dragon storms off and he calls forth his own offspring. He calls forth two great beasts. They're almost like Leviathan and Behemoth from the Old Testament, is almost what they seem like. He calls forth these two beasts to wage war against God's people. That's how the dragon wages war. That's the answer to chapter 12. He's gone off to wage war, and he's going to do it. Chapter 13, the whole content of it is him waging war through two beasts. He's not doing it directly. He's doing it through two beasts, one from the sea and one from the land. Almost everybody, I mean everybody, like literally everybody, even if you don't go to church, want nothing to do with Bible, Jesus, whatever, almost everybody has heard of at least part of this chapter, because there's a rather famous number at the end of this chapter in verse 18. This chapter is incredibly controversial. Lots of people have understood chapter 13 of Revelation as like coded descriptions of events that are going to happen just before the end of the world. And they might be right. I don't know. I don't know. But this is this is fertile soil, this chapter. It's fertile soil for conspiracy theories, for controversies, for watching for like a one world government led by two literal people. But they don't seem to be literally rising out of the ocean or literally monsters or anything. But a one world government led by two people, the Antichrist and the false prophet. And then that number at the end of the chapter, that famous number, you all know it, 666. That's been used over the years a lot to declare that a lot of people are the Antichrist. People all over the map, all over the spectrum, countless people, from popes through in the Catholic Church to Martin Luther trying to reform the Catholic Church, from JFK, great leaders of the 20th century, to horrible leaders of the 20th century, like Adolf Hitler. This chapter's been used to call them the Antichrist, from Barack Obama. There's a YouTube video that was circulating about Barack Obama being the Antichrist, to Ronald Wilson Reagan. Does anyone remember this? Ronald Wilson Reagan was... He's really interesting because every name, his first, middle, last name, all three names have six letters in them. Ronald Wilson Reagan. People were really worried about this. And it didn't help that he and Nancy, after they retired, they moved into a house located at 666 St. Cloud Road. Nancy changed it to 668 after they moved in, but it didn't help the people who were already convinced. My point is this. Chapter 13 of Revelation, Christians throughout the centuries, we're all reading this same chapter. And we're all thinking about and speculating about and talking about wildly different things. Crazy different things. There's a long, rich history of making this chapter about people, places, or events that it's probably not about, right? Probably. I don't have, confession, I don't have any like special knowledge about this chapter. I don't have any like access to like any secret about it. So how in the world can we hope to make sense of chapter 13 of Revelation? So I'd like to, what our plan is today is I'm going to try something a little bit different. Most weeks I do most of my talking after we've read the passage. Obviously, I'm not doing that this week. Obviously, I'm doing most of my talking before we read the passage. I want to do that because I want to lay groundwork for what kind of world John is living in and what kind of world his churches are living in. I think if we can lay some sort of groundwork, some sort of history, some sort of culture about what they're living through, that might help us see this chapter not through our eyes, the eyes that find Barack Obama or Napoleon or Martin Luther or whoever, the eyes, if we can see this passage through the eyes of the original audience, of its original readers, that might be a little more helpful, because we said like during our third week, actually, we said that we need to be reminded that Revelation originally came in the mailbox. Like in somebody's mailbox. The entire book, even chapter 13, is ancient mail. It's ancient mail. So how would somebody in Sardis or Laodicea or Ephesus have understood not only this letter, but this part of the letter? This part of the letter. How would they have understood this chapter? Because I think just like knowing something about 21st century politics and culture helps us to make sense of what would be otherwise like an incredibly puzzling image up on the screen, I think perhaps knowing something about first century politics and culture in the Roman Empire, that might help us make some sense of this chapter. It might make the chapter jump off the page a little bit in a way. Or maybe not. We may all just walk out of here baffled in some sort of way. So over the next couple of minutes, look something like this. I want to do a quick history lesson. It really is quick. I want to read the passage. When I start talking after the passage, it's not going to be for long. And then we'll come to the table. We'll make just a reflection after we read the passage. Sound good? Okay. Quick history lesson. What kind of world does John on the island of Patmos, writing to seven churches in Asia Minor in present-day Turkey, what kind of world does he live in? He lives, and by the way, I just threw Wikipedia up here. I'm going to be throwing Wikipedia up here just to let you know that I'm not making anything up. Just to let you know that you could be following along on your phone if you wanted to be on Wikipedia. What kind of world does he live in? Why, the short answer is that John and his churches, they live in a world dominated by the Roman Empire. If you're interested at all in history, if you've ever taken that up as a hobby, and then you start browsing through documentaries or books or something, there is a reason why there's so much on Roman history. It's on the Roman Empire in particular, on the Caesars. It's because for century after century, after century, after century, Rome ruled the known world. It was all there was for many people. In its early centuries, Rome had grown as like this democratic republic. But by the first century, by John's day, it had recently, in like the last 100 years or so, evolved into a dictatorship led by a king named Caesar, named after old Julius Caesar, the very first guy kind of claiming the throne as his own and kind of dismantling the republic. From the perspective of like the average Jew or Christian or resident of Asia Minor, forget even like religious convictions, Rome was like this unstoppable power ruling the world from across the Mediterranean Sea. Ruling from Italy, right? It's from across the sea. The power of Rome had traveled from across the sea and now dominated every bit of their lives. Like, imagine standing on the seashore for a second. Standing on the seashore and you're looking out at the sea, and all of a sudden you see something rising from the sea. It's actually a ship coming from over the horizon. It's rising over the horizon. And it's now imagine that is a fleet of U.S. battleships coming over the horizon, rising from the sea, rising like some sort of amazing, marvelous, monstrous thing coming to conquer your land. That's the way Rome felt to the earliest people. Jews and Christians especially, they had ways of talking about this because they had read the scroll of Daniel. They'd read the scroll of Daniel, this ancient scroll that's in your Old Testament, that described world empires rising, particularly Daniel 7, rising beasts coming out of the sea are actually world empires that are coming up like monsters conquering the world. And that's the way Rome felt. Even if you hadn't read the scroll of Daniel, that's the way Rome felt. It's this thing that just dominates everything. The great city on seven hills, the great city of Rome, it ruled the world like this powerful lion ruling the savannah. You don't want to mess with that animal. That thing will bite you. That thing will kill you. It'll rip your face off. Have you seen the claws on that thing? Have you seen the teeth on that thing? Have you seen its armies? Don't mess with those seven heads. I mean, those seven hills is what I mean to say about Rome. Check Revelation 17. There's an interesting note there. As a monarchy, Rome had had a relatively stable succession of kings that called themselves Caesars. King after king, Caesar after Caesar, horn after horn, as the scroll of Daniel would have called them, had come and gone in relative peace from Octavian up there at the top, called Great King or Augustus Caesar, who had stabilized the empire after his uncle Julius Caesar's assassination, down through Tiberius, who had ruled when Jesus was crucified, down through Caligula and Claudius. But then things start going south. Things start going south because by the time you get to John's day, the whole Roman system seemed like it was maybe about to, on the verge of falling apart. There had been, like recently, down there at the bottom, there had been this recent, certifiably crazy king named Nero. He'd been genuinely bad for like the entire empire, especially for Christians, but then he'd committed suicide in AD 68. And slide four, that left the world in chaos. Left it in chaos. There was a single year after Nero's death where four people sat on the throne of Rome. It's like there was no peaceful transition of power after him. There was a lot of bloodshed. In the span of 18 months, you had four dead Caesars. One president being assassinated is enough to throw our country into mourning, into chaos, to make the world feel like it's falling apart. Imagine four of them. Four. From the perspective of like everyday citizens in Rome, it probably felt like this giant bear of a government had been given like some sort of death blow. Suffered a mortal wound, perhaps. But then everything stabilized when someone finally took the throne and did not die. He managed not to die. There was a guy by the name of Vespasian who stabilized everything, and then it's like the king of the jungle is back. Claws, teeth, we got it all. It's fully recovered, stronger than ever. Slide five, Rome probably felt stronger than ever to Jews and Christians especially, because within months, literally months of Vespasian taking power, Jerusalem and its temple had been destroyed, completely destroyed. He sent his trusted general Titus, heir to the throne, Titus actually became Caesar, to squash a rebellion that had been boiling over for a couple of years. These Jews down there in Judea had been rebelling, and I'm just going to squash it. And suddenly, the great city of David, Jerusalem, is destroyed. Suddenly, the Jewish people's temple, the place that Jesus visited and taught and drove out money changers from, you know, the grand stones of this temple, the promised dwelling place of the one true God, the temple's literally gone. Destroyed. It's gone. It's in pieces, torn apart, burned to the ground. There is nothing left. It's a feat that it was ever built, and it's a feat that they actually tore it apart too. It's amazing act of aggressive, terrible reverse engineering that they were able to destroy it. If you lived at this time, it would probably look like, when you looked at Rome, you'd probably like see its technology, you'd see its power, you'd see its long history, you'd see its marvelous recovery from this mortal wound, and you would say, who is like Rome? Who can wage war against it? this brand new Caesar, Vespasian, he was really dead set on making sure that Rome continued to be a great and powerful empire through the world. His slogan, if he was campaigning, might have been, make Rome great again. It might have been. Because he's like wanting to like make every, like restore all of the great traditions that have been present in Rome. And so whatever decade John happens to be writing Revelation in, Vespasian had very recently been restoring all kinds of classic, great things to the people of Rome, including what we would call the imperial cult. Including the imperial cult is something that he restored. That's basically just means that the official religion, the required religion of the entire empire was to worship the Caesars as gods. Worship the Caesars as gods. Other Caesars had done this before, just making Rome great again, just tapping into its history. We still have coins that we can see that call Caesar Nero a son of God. There are still inscriptions that you can go see. That one is in Ephesus, where you can read Caesar Augustus hailed as the savior, the divine savior of the world. There had been plenty of heads of state who had called themselves gods before Vespasian. Vespasian was just bringing back a tradition and making it official state policy. From a Jewish or Christian point of view, though, it doesn't matter how many kings, how many Caesars, how many heads of states, how many horns, how many heads, how many head after head. You can call yourself God. It does not matter how many of you say this. You are all just speaking blasphemous names. You're calling yourselves blasphemous things. You're speaking blasphemy. You're defying the one true God. You're convincing people to worship you, human beings. You're convincing people to worship a giant system rather than the God. You're persuading people that the Roman Empire is the only ultimate hope for the world. And these people, that doesn't seem like it would go over really well if you called it blasphemy. You know what I mean? Official state religion is this. Nah, I disagree. That's blasphemy. There's plenty of biblical stories that, you know, that Jewish people, Christians, could draw strength from, saying, no, we're not going to do that. We might even be thrown into a fiery furnace, but we are not bowing down to this. The people who refused to worship Caesar, to worship Rome, worship the goddess Roma, were punished and persecuted. Not usually by Rome itself, though. This is interesting. Not usually by Rome itself. Even to this day, even with our modern travel and our modern technology and phones and video cameras and all that, the federal government doesn't do much in the way of law enforcement, does it? No, it's too big. It's too far away. It can't handle it. Law enforcement has to be local, right? It has to be local. It has to be Adams County Sheriff's Department. It has to be City of Denver Police. Culture and beliefs and policy enforcement maybe are a little like plants. You know what I mean? They have to like take root locally. It doesn't matter how well they're doing over there across the sea. They have to start taking root locally if they're going to stick around, right? Roman culture, Roman beliefs, Roman policy enforcement needs to start growing out of, needs to start rising out of local soil. Because once it starts growing locally, once it starts like rising up out of the earth, then it becomes really hard to stop. And by the time John's writing, that's exactly what's happened. That's exactly what's happened. The people of Pergamum, for example, in chapter 2, had really begun to worship Caesar as a god. Satan has his throne there in Pergamum, he says. They'd really begun to worship Caesar as a god. They'd begun to buy into it. They'd begun to believe it. Local people were starting to throw festivals to rival the Super Bowl in honor of the emperor. The local patrons would set up statues honoring Caesar. And sometimes they would hire the IT experts of the day to engineer the statues so that they would magically move or speak or do, look at this, the power of the gods, the power of Caesar. This isn't in the Bible that you read. This is other ancient sources telling us these sorts of things. Much of the meat that you could buy in the marketplace had already, before it ever got out on the counter, it had been religiously dedicated to the emperor as a sacrifice. What do you do with that? What do you do with that? That's assuming for just a second that you can even get into the marketplace. That's assuming because a lot of local governments had begun requiring people to make like a small sacrifice, a pinch of incense in the fire, something, before they could even get in worship of the emperor, before you could even get into the marketplace. Are you loyal to the, you can imagine somebody being really excited about this job, sitting at the gate, taking tickets for a sporting event or something. Okay, pinch your incense, loyal to the emperor, make your sacrifice. Okay, here's your stamp. You can come and go for the day. Like a Chuck E. Cheese sort of stamp, a zoo sort of stamp. I mean, really, honestly, this is the world that John lived in. A world ruled by Rome, a world where the locals every day were actually giving life to, they were giving breath to putting into practice all of the ideas of Rome. They were buying into it. This is the world of John's churches. They could, this is what was presented to them. You can either buy into Rome too, you can sacrifice to the emperor, you can fly under the radar, you can go about the everyday business of life, but you will be losing all of your integrity. Be losing all of your integrity. You'll be selling your soul, selling your soul for the sake of convenience. That's our short history lesson. Let's read the passage. Let's look at the cartoon and see if we can recognize anything familiar. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to wage war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus. The dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on its horns, and on each head was a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was filled with wonder and followed the beast. People worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. And they also worshipped the beast and asked, who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it? The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise its authority for 42 months. That's the same period of time as the woman in the wilderness, the same period of time as the two witnesses a couple of chapters ago. It opened its mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. It was given power to wage war against God's holy people and to conquer them. And it was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast. All whose names are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life, the Lamb who was slain from the creation of the world. Whoever has ears, let him hear. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword, they will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of God's people. It's like there's bad things that are going to happen. You're going to have to patient endurance. Verse 11, then I saw a second beast coming out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. It exercised all the authority of the first beast on its behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. And it performed great signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to the earth in full view of the people. Because of the signs it was given power to perform on behalf of the first beast, it deceived the inhabitants of the earth. It ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. The second beast was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast, so the image could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. It also forced all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hands or on their foreheads, so that they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast, or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the person who has insight calculate the name, the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. That number is 666. I think this might be something like God's political cartoon. I think. It's not a silly cartoon. It's serious business. But there's a challenge. It's serious business that challenges all of us. There's a challenge here because I don't think it's a challenge like we might think. I don't think it's the challenge of figuring out exactly who is the Antichrist. I don't think that's what it is. Because despite all the mystique surrounding it, all of the conspiracy theories, the number 666, really, if you ask scholars, it's not that mysterious. I've included this, by the way, in the last page of the notes this week. John challenges his original readers to figure out this number. The original readers of Revelation, they didn't know about Reagan or Obama or any popes or anything like that. But what they did know about was a recently dead, certifiably crazy king. And if you spell Caesar Nero in Hebrew, Hebrew's like Roman numerals. It's got numeric values to some of the letters. If you spell Caesar Nero in Hebrew and then add up all of the numbers, what do you think you get? That's right. You get 666 is a cryptogram. It's a cryptogram. Or rather, it's an easy cryptogram for Caesar Nero. For Caesar Nero. The math works just as well today as it did for John's original readers. But I think there's a reason why John writes the way he does, because I think he's warning us about something bigger than any just one person. He's not concerned about a recently dead, certifiably crazy king. Not that. This is bigger than just one person. In Revelation, Jesus, through John, is always making things strange with the hopes that we'll see, with the hopes that we'll see clearly. I think he's challenging us to recognize, not a person, recognize a pattern more than a person. It's a challenge, I think this is a challenge not only to John's generation back then, not just to history's last generation someday down the road, I don't know when. I think this is a challenge to every generation. He's calling the church to wisdom, to figure out the number. I don't think he's merely just asking people back then, decipher this cryptogram, it'll be really interesting. I think he's asking all of us to be on the lookout for a pattern. For a pattern. Because 666 is not just a cryptogram for Caesar Nero, it's also falling short of 7 3 times. We've seen that John likes to use 7 as like a number of fullness, of completeness, of creation as it should be, of perfection. And 666 falls short of that in triplicate. It's like saying, figure out, calculate what falls short of perfection and have nothing to do with that. If you embrace that, if you make that the where you're placing all your hope, where what the basket in which you're putting all of your eggs, you're embracing, what you're actually embracing is death. You're embracing something that has nothing to do, verse 8, with the book of life, with life itself. I think more than, slide 9, last slide, I think more than wanting us to ask who is the Antichrist, Jesus is wanting us to begin to discern, begin to think, calling us to wisdom and saying, what is Antichrist? What's Antichrist? What's anti-Jesus? What's anti-Lamb? What's anti-giving to others, even when it's painful? What's anti-love to the point of death? What are the things that actually, they promise us safety, they promise us security, they promise us fulfillment. In all honesty, they promise us salvation, but then they also demand our worship. They demand our allegiance. They demand to be made ultimate. Through a vision to John, I think Jesus is calling all of us into good news. I think he's calling us to himself. He's saying, use your minds. You have a mind. Use it, my people. Think through these things. There's a lot of stuff from far over the sea, even growing locally, that does not line up with life. Doesn't line up with real and true and lasting life. And I don't want you to miss it. I don't want you to miss it. The enemy doesn't just wage war with a sword. The enemy also deceives with things that are counterfeit. Life. He likes to lure people into things. Verse 11, they look like life. They look like the Lamb. But when they speak, it's actually the dragon's voice. It's the voice of death. It's the voice of death. It might be the imperial cult in the first century. Yes, I'm pretty sure it's the imperial cult in the first century, but it's more than that. It's more than that. This calls for wisdom. This calls for wisdom for every generation because I think the dragon's still waging war. Dragon's still waging war, still hurting people through really big systems, still tempting us, luring us away with counterfeit life. Some people like worry that, like, is the next credit card or the next piece of technology that might be the mark of the beast. But I think a better question to ask might be, what are the large patterns of this world? What are the large patterns of our lives where we are knowingly selling our integrity for, like, momentary pleasure? Because those are the moments that I think we're courting the beast. We're asking for its mark. When we buy into a system where that tells us that more money will be more security for your family, where some debt, just more, a little more debt is worth just a little bit of quick pleasure. That little bit of more income, it really should be used for me. When that's the pattern, maybe we should look at our credit cards. If that's the pattern that we're living in, if that's the pattern that we're buying into, maybe we should worry about our credit cards just a little bit. Maybe that is the mark. Because that sounds a little anti-Christ. It sounds like a six. It sounds like a six. Like it's falling short of perfection. It's less than alive. People sometimes worry that, like, the United Nations or the next political leader might be the Antichrist. And for all I know, it could be. I don't know. But despite the impression that we may get from the news or social media, our safety and security does not hinge on this election this week. It does not. That's a lie from the dragon. If we're losing sleep over current events, if we're finding ourselves angry over politics, fearful over politics. If we're far more concerned about whoever is living in the White House than loving whoever's living in the next house. If we're speaking hatefully or unfairly about a person because they're voting for the wrong person. I think the dragon's deceiving us. I think the dragon's deceiving us. Today, every day, we are challenged to know his number, to have his number, and to refuse to buy what he's selling. So may we have patient endurance and faithfulness while evil still lashes about in the world. May we have wisdom to recognize every beast that the dragon unleashes on this world and resist their violence and seduction. And may all of us, may the church, may we have ears to hear the Spirit calling us into that true and lasting life that no mind can imagine, that no enemy can counterfeit, and that absolutely all are invited into.